waiting for a couple of staff members. Are you ready to start? Okay, are we all ready to start? Okay, terrific. Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Mechanic. I am an assistant director at the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And for purposes of this particular roundtable, I'd like to also point out that I particularly focus on private companies and not-for-profit organizations. And while that won't be the exclusive focus of this roundtable, you're certainly welcome to talk about any types of companies and organizations. Definitely want to make sure that we spend sufficient time delving into the unique issues, and if there are unique issues, for private companies and not-for-profit organizations. This is actually the second of two public roundtables that we are holding today here in Los Angeles on our leases project. We've previously had roundtables in jointly with the International Accounting Standards Board, or IASB, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, London, Norwalk, Connecticut, and there will be some roundtables in Singapore tomorrow. Roundtables are an important part of our public due process. They help us to better understand and to further explore in an interactive way the feedback that we receive in comment letters. As all of you know, the LEASES project that we've been working on jointly with the IASB is a very important and wide-ranging project, and it's aimed at improving the accounting for leases by both lessees and lessors. We'll be discussing here the revised proposal that was issued by the two boards earlier in 2013. And having read the letters, I think we're going to have a very good good session together. So before we begin, let's go around the room and introduce ourselves briefly and talk also briefly about the organizations or groups of organizations that you're representing, starting with Matt Esposito. Please also speak into the mic, as I'll go over in a little while. We're recording this session for playback.
Hi, everyone. My name is Matt Esposito. I'm a FASB staff member.
Hi, I am Michael Beck, and I'm a partner with Cohn Resnick, and I'm a National Director of Accounting and Auditing.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt Brewer. I'm here representing the National Association of College and University Business Officers. And in my day job, I'm controller of Caltech, a world-renowned science and technology university nearby here in Pasadena.
Larry Smith, member of the FASB.
Steve Brown, a member of FASB's Private Company Council. I'm also a vice president for U.S. Bank and manage portfolio risk in our community bank business line.
My name is Steve Controlis. I'm the chief financial officer of a company called Triton Container International Limited. We own in excess of 1 million physical pieces of container equipment, both dry vans and refrigerated containers that we lease to shipping lines around the world.
Tom Linsmeyer, FASB.
Jeff Easton, Chief Financial Officer of Med One Capital. We're an independent lessor based in Salt Lake City, Utah, kind of a mid-sized company with well over 1 million pieces of equipment, but much smaller in nature.
Hi, I'm John Lacey. I'm a professor of accounting at Cal State Long Beach. But I'm here representing the California Society of CPAs. We're 40,000 members in California. We have an Accounting Principles and Auditing Standards Committee that writes the response letter on behalf of the California Society. There are 53 members of that committee, and I'm really here representing that committee. Most of the members are regional, local practitioners in accounting firms here in California. So to a large extent, our comments reflect the comments of those smaller firm practitioners. We also have five former ACSEC members and an EITF member and some folks who have pretty good accounting standards background too. But really the committee is primarily smaller regional practitioners.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Croker with the FASB.
Hey, I'm Mark Scheer. I'm here representing the Healthcare Financial Management Association. I'm also a partner with KPMG LLP.
And it's Sparks. I'm the controller of Bechtel Group in San Francisco, which is a large engineering and construction company, but we are private. And so I was actually a party both to the engineering and construction letter that was that Marianne represented us on today, and also we wrote our own letter as Bechtel.
Hello, I'm Daryl Buck, member of the FASB.
I'm Brett Steffen. I'm the controller at Great America Financial Services Corporation. We're a small ticket equipment lessor located out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Hi, I'm Carol Yule. I'm the audit manager for Milburn Ray & Company. We're a small CPA firm in Grapevine, Texas, and our clients are small private companies.
Hi, I'm Lisa Muehlbauer. I'm with the FASB staff.
Hi, Danielle Zayer, FASB staff.
Okay, thank you. And thank you again in advance for your participation in this roundtable. A few more administrative items before we begin. I mentioned before that I'd like each of you to be sure to speak into the microphone. The reason for that is not only so that the audience members here can hear you, but also because we're recording this session as we did with the morning session, and we'll be posting that recording to our website within the next few days to help to be available for those who may not have been able to attend in person. In addition to speaking directly into the microphone, please be sure to identify yourselves if I have failed to do so in calling upon you. And then with regard to calling upon you, it would be very helpful if, just to kind of keep some order to the discussion and call upon people in the order in which they have asked to speak, please put your placard on end, and Danielle and I will do our best to try to keep track of who to call in what order. However, while we will keep that general cue, if you do have a particular point that you'd like to make that directly pertains to a point that someone else is currently making or has just made, rather than wait in a queue, I would ask you to raise both hands like this, and I will notice you and call upon you as soon as possible rather than waiting in queue. And I think that is that's all the administrative stuff. So with that, we have a lot to cover. I'll turn it over to Danielle Zayer, who will introduce the first topic.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. So everyone should have a copy of our agenda, and we have four topics that we would like to discuss today. If we can, let's try to stick to the topic on hand instead of getting ahead of ourselves. We'll hopefully have plenty of time to get to all the topics today over the next 3 hours. And so with that, I'd like to start with topic one, which is the lessee and lessor accounting models. And let's take about the next 30 minutes just to focus on the lessee model. And as you know, the exposure draft proposes that all entities will recognize assets and liabilities. You'll have a right of use asset, an obligation to make lease payments. But for lessees, there's two different types, a type A lease or a type B lease. And the difference between the two would be the income statement recognition. So you'd have interest and amortization for type A leases, and a straight line rental expense for type B leases. So the exposure draft talks about that in general for leases of other than property would receive the type A accounting, whereas most leases of property would receive the type B accounting. And so if you look at page 3 of our agenda, we'd like to focus on questions 1, 2, and 4 to talk about this dual approach to the accounting model and to talk about the differences between different types of leases and whether a dual model approach best reflects the economics of those types of leases. And if you think that we've made the correct distinction in distinguishing between property and leases of other than property. And we also are interested to hear if you have any suggestions for the boards for any changes that would make the proposals simplified or easier to apply, or any other thoughts on where we have differentiated between the two different types of leases and how we've made that differentiation. So I'll turn it over to the group to talk about the lessee accounting model.
Okay. Let's start with Steve.
Thank you, and I'll just start by saying thank you to everybody here at the FASB for including us in the discussion and making this a forum where I think we certainly are grateful for the opportunity to participate. Just as a by way of background about our organization, we, like I think one of the companies that was here this morning, are a full operational organization. In other words, we are a leasing company, but the left-hand side of our balance sheet, unlike a financial institution, consists entirely of physical pieces of equipment. So when we think about what it is that we do for a living, we think of it from the perspective of being an operating company. And our customers, likewise, are beneficiaries from that operating activity. And so my comments are going to stray probably at some point to the lessor side of this, and I will get to the lessee side of this. But I wanted to just start by observing that we've gone back and looked at the 600-plus letters that have been received, and I think as a very admirable objective, the FASB has started out by tackling this project by saying that the idea here is to improve and enhance usability of financial statements. And almost without question, including the letters we've seen from the U.S. banks, which represent about a third of the total assets that are deployed in the U.S. banking system, international banks, which those who submitted letters represent about 10% of those assets, the associations, the Wells Fargo equity analysts, the FASB Investor Advisory Committee, and Standard & Poor's have voiced, I think, some significant concerns about the adoption of this standard. And while we're supportive always of, because we are users of financial statements as well, we're very supportive of getting broader access to financial information, better understanding our customers, better understanding credit risk. I believe, and I think the momentum and the support that we've seen behind this initiative is about enhanced disclosure. And that really is a path that I think addresses many of the user perspective concerns here. But talking then specifically about the lessee and the lessee approach, I would say there are some issues, and again, we think about this from the perspective, since we don't lease a lot of equipment, we think about it from the perspective of our customer base. And I think the first thing I would observe with you is, for you, is that in our situation, the substance of the transaction really matters to the lessee. In other words, the person making the decision to lease 500 marine cargo containers from us is not somebody who is on the financial side of a large shipping line. They have nothing to do with the financial, the right-hand side of that company's balance sheet. They don't get involved in capital budgeting or spending or covenants. They don't have a clue about the way that part of the business works. And by putting these assets and the associated liabilities in the lessee balance sheet, you really, and we're talking about a behavioral shift that I think is going to have a profound impact not only on our business, but the way that people lease rail cars, the way they lease trucks, the way they may lease automobiles. And I think that's something that really needs to be taken into consideration. There's a mismatch, I think, between the economic realities of a financing transaction, an on-balance sheet transaction, and an operating lease transaction. There is no intent to transfer title in anything that we do in terms of the operating nature of our business. We see our assets back repeatedly. We release them, we repair them, and we manage them intensively. There's a great deal, I think, of subjectivity from the leasing, from the lessee side in terms of assumptions that have to be made, and I know some of this was mentioned this morning around contract, asset-based significance, relevant factors, lessee intent, that I think needs a lot more illumination. And again, I go back to what I said at the outset, that the current model, I feel, and we feel strongly, can be enhanced and offer the same substantive benefit to the financial user community. We raise billions of dollars a year in the banking sector, much like ILFC does, from investors. We want them to understand how our business works. And being able to disclose that information in footnote disclosure, I think, goes very, very far. Maybe not the full balance sheet approach, but goes very far in addressing some of this.
Daryl Buck.
Now, Steve, can I ask a follow-up question? You alluded to concerns about behavioral changes in mm-hmm. your customers. Can you give us a little bit more flavor for the types of behavioral changes you would expect?
Absolutely. So today, as I said, the decision that is made by the lessee in our business when making a decision to rent a trailer or rent a series of rail cars are made by operational people in the organization. So they're on the front lines. They understand what the operational need of the business is. They're picking up the phone. They're calling somebody in a local office in our business, a related business center, and they're saying, I need 500 containers. And I need them in these three locations, and I need them in the next 3 days. And that satisfies, that ensures that cargo is going to continue to flow and their business model is going to continue to work. If we change that decision and say, that 500-unit lease is going to now appear on your balance sheet as a liability. What you've done is you've recharacterized or you've altered that decision and now made it a decision that is really a capital budgeting decision. And it's a decision that has to be made within the confines of what are the covenant implications, what are the borrowing implications. It changes the nature of what is a purely operational decision to one that has much greater ramification.
And given the fact that we've been told that users currently would take operating lease expenses and capitalize those for purposes of leverage ratio calculations, don't you think that your customers' management would be needing to take into account committing to these future cash flows anyway? I mean, it essentially, from a user's perspective, is committing them to the same sort of capital commitment you're describing.
I think it's within, some bandwidth that they do what you just described. So a large part or a significant part of our portfolio is very short-term leasing. So it leases that get picked up in containers get picked up in location A. They might stay on lease for 6 months, a year, 18 months, and then they get turned right back in. They're purely operational. So they wouldn't enter even into the planning or the discussion phase with somebody at the CFO or the treasury component of the decision-making chain in some of these organizations, and they really are operating expenses. They're a cost of doing the business, and if they were replaced by ownership, some of those costs, they treat these containers like their own, like they are owned when they're under their care, because the last thing they want is to have something fail. So the only thing that's different if they buy them is that they finance them. They operate them exactly the same way.
But our model on short-term leases would treat it as an operating lease, would it not?
The 12-month exception would. But we have leases that are, can range. The average long-term lease in our portfolio now has a maturity of about 4 years. The average stick, what we call the stick factor for a master lease, which is the shorter-term operational, is a little bit over 2 years. So, and that varies, again, depending on changing trade patterns, depending on changing demand flows, on new equipment pricing. I mean, it changes based on a lot of variables that are really, again, I use the word ignorant or independent of what happens on the right-hand side of the balance sheet.
Okay. Larry Smith, then Matt Brewer, then Annette Sparks.
So you've indicated that behavior will change if we put these on the balance sheet and that the decisions will switch from the operating people to the treasury-type people. And I'm not saying that I necessarily accept this, but we've heard previously at other roundtables that what we call this thing, this credit on the balance sheet, matters. So if we don't call it debt but call it a lease obligation or something like that, that will matter. or may matter and may influence things. My question to you is whether you agree with that and whether that's a simple fix, if you will, or whether that's just kind of like smoke and mirrors or what have you, and also whether it matters whether you're a type A or a type B lease in terms of the Treasury type decisions.
Right. And I think, I don't have a concrete answer, unfortunately, for you there. I think that behavioral change will be determined based on how decisions get made within each organization. But I certainly believe that impacting the balance sheet in the way that is articulated in the revised exposure draft will change that decision-making for a large number of our customers. How they end up characterizing it, how they end up treating it. It was interesting this morning when I think at the end you were talking about the changes to adoption or transition. And many times what happens, as I think everybody knows, is that when financial analysts look at our financial results, they do what they want to get the right results. I mean, if you're selling a company, somebody's going to say, go back and adjust the last 5 years of earnings. Whether this FASB change was implemented or mandated to change or not, they're going to want to see those. So I think it's really going to, the answer to that question is really going to come down to the individual organization. And then type A, type B, I mean, again, we're not a quote-unquote beneficiary of the type B aspect presently because it's a pretty narrow definition, but I don't really think that has a profound impact. And to be honest with you, I'm not a real estate finance person, so I don't know that I'd know the answer to that question.
Okay. Matt Brewer's next.
So I have a couple of points on number one. These are a little bit more detailed. First, I guess in general, we find that users of financial statements of college and universities do want to see obligations for leases on balance sheets. However, we don't find that they have particular preferences as to how the expense is treated in the income statement, but in general, the thought is that what's being proposed is overly complex. With respect to what is being proposed as far as the flow of the expenses, interest expense is a touchy subject for any of those who do work with the federal government, and my colleague from Bechtel has a good example in their comment letter. So from a direct perspective, I would defer to her to speak about that, but also, so the government currently accepts as a direct cost rent expense. They do not accept interest expense. So this is also true when we prepare what's known as our facilities and administrative or indirect cost rates. Those are used to bill the government for the indirect costs associated with the conduct of research that's sponsored by them. So interest is treated in a certain way and typically looked at by those who audit those cost proposals as directly related to what's more considered debt, that is something we owe to a bank, something we owe to bondholders. So this would really change how we bring that in. We think that would require significant consultation with the Office of Management and Budget to try to rework that. And if it wasn't reworked, we would find currently acceptable costs that go into the preparation of our rates would now be considered unallowable. So those are our two general comments on that. We have a significant comment on lessor, but it sounds like we're holding those for later.
Yeah, we'll be getting to those in a little while.
Okay.
Annette, you're next.
Well, first in comment to that, I would agree with Matt's characterization. I think we, just to finish up on that subject, I think the FAR regulations are very hard to get anybody to change, and to your comment this morning, it's hard to know who to go talk to.
I wasn't making a comment about closed government.
my experience in working with the government is that they're fairly intransigent, and it's very difficult to find the right person to talk to. So, I mean, I think it's a real issue, and that actually hits bottom line, because if you incur a cost, it's a reimbursable contract, and you don't get reimbursed, that comes straight out of net income. Okay, so that's a big issue for us. Back to some of the stuff Steve was talking about, we're a little different, but in a way, we're more the lessee. We're not really a lessor much, other than internally between our own legal entities. But You know, we do lease a lot of equipment, and we do lease it from people, usually from a period of time, anywhere from 2 to 4 years is kind of our norm. And Marianne talked about this morning as it goes along with the project. Typically, we lease this from companies who are in a leasing business, like Caterpillar or John Deere or people of that nature. So they expect to get this equipment back. This is not something that they're giving to us. And so we don't see it as a financing. We see it as a, you know, a borrowing and paying for it for a period of time. And so at a minimum, I think, you know, I know there was some discussion today about maybe eliminating it, and I don't think that went over very well. But I mean, I can appreciate that if we're really just flowing that through the customer, I still think that has some merit. But at a minimum, I think allowing some of those things to be type B, I don't think it's a financing where you actually have a liability where you should have an accretion, a discount, where you should have a different earnings pattern where it's front-end loaded versus straight line over time. I think those are really meant to be essentially relatively short term. Okay, I granted they're not a year, but I think a year is too restrictive for the definition of short term. And I think having only be applied to real estate is also too restrictive. I think you need to look at the underlying types of leases and whether, I mean, a simple way to look at it, which it would be the things that used to really apply as financing leases and used to be capital leases, that I would say those probably are type A, okay? But the things that were operating leases and really were not ever intended to own or take title or be a part of it, that they would be more of fall in that type B thing. And so broaden that definition of type B and allow for things to be looked at based on the nature of the agreement. Again, I think some of them, I'm not a real proponent of putting it all on the balance sheet to begin with, but if we are going to do that, I would say, you know, let's broaden this definition of type B and allow for things to be looked at more on the nature of the underlying lease agreement.
So. Okay, Jim Grover.
Quick follow-up to that. At prior roundtables, people have suggested that if we're going to have two types of lease, almost what you said, keep the current dividing line either in FAS 13 or IAS 17, they're similar, but FAS 13 with much more prescriptive guidance
right.
in how you determine that. Is that sort of along the nature of the comment? I get
yeah.
that you question
I mean,
whether they should be on balance sheet.
I would say the old capital lease criteria, if you met the old capital lease criteria, and maybe with some few little, you know, adjustments to that to make that clearer or whatever, then you probably really do have a debt obligation, and that probably should go on your balance sheet. I really wouldn't fight with that because I've always thought that was okay. I think where we get into the issue of concern about this is when you had really what was purely an operating lease. There was no intent to transfer title. It's relatively short term in terms of the life of what you're leasing. You don't there the thing has more, you know, quite a bit of economic value left. The lessor expects to get it back and use it again. Those are the ones I think that are the most problematic, and always making those be treated like a financing where you set it up and you accrete the discount and therefore have interest expense. I think that's a real issue. And then, you know, again, what you call it is important too. I think this being able to call it rent, I think is going to be real important. Rent or whatever is going to be real important, no matter what you do with it.
Daryl Buck has a question.
So Annette, just if I could recap, I think what you're saying is your first choice would be to leave it as is.
It would.
Your second choice, if I heard you right, is if we're going to put everything on the balance sheet, then you draw the line with the FAS 13. So what you're saying is for those today that are operating leases, you prefer the straight line P&L treatment.
Absolutely. Very well said.
Okay, Mark Scher is next.
So to give you some perspective on the healthcare industry, which is a big piece of the economy here, we have a wide range of leases from very tiny up to fairly significant. A lot of it's focused on medical equipment and other pieces of equipment with some property. Occasionally there's some buildings. And almost exclusively we are on the lessee side. So that's the perspective that the HFMA was speaking from. I'm going to agree with a lot of the comments I heard here, but want to relate them back to our industry. I heard a little bit about, from Steve, the operational changes in a company that occurs when you suddenly go to a capital expenditure. And that's typically a very rigorous process in a healthcare setting for a couple of reasons. One, they set that budget early in the year and they monitor it fairly closely. But second, where there's debt associated with it, there's a lot of significant covenants associated with that. The debt put out by healthcare systems is huge nationally, so they have to watch those covenants very closely. And there's a lot of concern if, in fact, these assets come on the books, what will happen in the transition period because they have these existing covenants. So there are some operational changes that will be very challenging. I think in terms of the complexity that was raised across the room is another one. Some of the ideas, I think, in practice make sense. I could understand the benefit of bringing assets and liabilities on the books, but there are so many variables, assumptions, and different decisions that have to be made. I'm not certain that you'd get the consistency that you were hoping for in going through that process because there's a lot of subjectivity in those assumptions. We, in healthcare, much like in higher ed, we deal with the government on reimbursement issues, and how these amounts are shown on the income statement could, in fact, impact how certain organizations are reimbursed for costs that they incur as a part of the healthcare provision of services. Medicare is one that reimburses for certain types of healthcare costs, and there may be a change as a result of that. So as we look at it, I lean a lot towards what Annette had indicated. I think the guidelines we have right now are relatively well understood, easy to implement. We're not necessarily against the concept of bringing assets on the books and liabilities on the books, but there seems to be a lot of challenges with getting consistency and an accurate representation and making something be meaningful to the users of the financial statements. In our industry, in many cases, the analysts make a correction for operating leases to make certain they understand what's going on with those already. I'm not certain they wouldn't have to make some other adjustment if we brought those things on the books.
Okay, John Lacey's next, and then Jeff Easton.
At our committee, we discussed the general problem that so many different types of contracts have the word lease at the top. Some are clearly a purchase, some are clearly a casual use agreement, and so the question is where to draw this line. And our consensus at the last meeting when we discussed the ED was that we liked this proposal better than the last one, that the idea of having an A and B is better than just having an A. And also our members felt that they could implement this. So one of the big discussions that we have is, can a smaller practitioner actually make this work? And the consensus seemed to be yes, that they could make this work and make these distinctions. The one particular concern that we had was about the 12-month cutoff for leases, if there's a 12-month lease, and specifically if there's the option to renew the lease, why that would kick it out of being a lease that wouldn't have to be capitalized. The option would be the option of the lessee. It would give the lessee an opportunity to do that if they chose to, and as long as there is no economic incentive for them to exercise that option, we didn't understand why that would then cause the lease to be capitalized when there was no obligation for the lessee to undertake that option. I was telling Tom earlier, I'm also on the American Accounting Association Accounting Principles Committee. We write the letter on behalf of all the college professors, so I have a foot in each camp, which sometimes means I have to do the splits pretty significantly, as you can imagine. But we also talked about the option issue at the American Accounting Association, also said, you know, if it's an option, that's really an advantage to the lessee, for what it's worth. And one last thought, I also teach for a couple of banks, and they do consider the lease obligation, but not as formally. So when they don't restate financial statements when they compute the debt covenants, for example, but they do look at a multiple of rentals as a more casual assessment, kind of a sensitivity analysis, if you will, in making their leasing decision. So it is considered, but it's not considered as specifically, at least at the couple of banks where I teach.
Okay. Jeff Easton.
Again, thank you for putting together this forum. We think this is fantastic. Before I make my comments, is it okay if I bleed into some lessor comments as well?
A little bit.
Okay. So I concur with many of my colleagues here on what they have said. We actually work 99.9% of our businesses in the healthcare world. And 40% of what we do are truly true operating leases. There are times where hospitals have zero desire to own that piece of equipment at the end of a lease or at the end of a committed term. Doesn't mean they may not renew it for another 12 months or a month-to-month basis, but many times that is the decision that they are making up front. So 60% of our business falls into this other line of, let's call it financing. 40% definitely falls into where we view ourselves as an operator. And what we try to do, and I think what this is going to do is, from an independent lessor, we have built a niche of truly trying to do what is best and what that customer wants. And by implementing what is currently on the table, that completely takes that away, not only from our company, but from hundreds of other independent lessor companies like ours, who are really trying to serve a purpose and help, whether it be a hospital, a small company, whatever it is in rural America, succeed as a business. And so we think that's something that definitely should be thought of, and especially as we're talking about healthcare being a major national debate, we feel that we provide a very useful presence in the market to help hospitals acquire equipment that they may only need for 6 days or 10 days. And I understand that would fall under the 12 months, but sometimes it goes 18 months or 24 months, depending on how long they're going to need that for. So I second what Annette said. I would love to have it not on there, but at the same time, I step back into where I got my training at Ernst & Young, and yes, there is a committed obligation. It's hard to say that there shouldn't be something on the balance sheet. From a lessor standpoint, all of this is already on the books from a lessor standpoint. Our users, our financial statements are Fortune 500 large medical manufacturers. Wells Fargo is a large national bank, and then some other mid-sized banks throughout America. I've never had one of them come to me and ask me for really any additional information than what we already currently provide in a financial statement in analyzing what our financial statements are.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how changing anything from a lessor standpoint benefits anyone.
Okay, points made. Hold those thoughts. We're going to get to the lessor model shortly.
Jeff, can I make one follow-up question? There have been a couple of comments so far that have alluded to the transfer of title at the end. And as you know, that's one of the criteria for under current classification. But bear in mind that, you know, the objective of that classification system is different than what we're looking at here. That the current FAS 13 classification system is essentially looking to see if there are attributes present that essentially mean that the lessee has acquired the asset. Okay, what we're looking at with this new model is sort of, to some extent, divorcing the physical underlying from the right to use it. And so what we're saying is that the agreement that enables the lessee to control the right to use that for that term, even though there's no transfer of title either at the end or the beginning, that agreement creates rights and obligations that meet the definition of assets and liabilities. So I just wanted to make that, you know, that it is a subtle nuance, but I think it's very key to understanding the objective of what we're trying to do.
And Daryl, I agree with that. I can't disagree with that.
I think that one of the things you heard from people this morning and here, and back to my previous comments, but is also, you know, that takes care of the balance sheet side. But when you get ready to think about how does that roll through your income statement, I think from an operating perspective,
you know, people still think of this as rent, okay? and so it's rent, and that's what it is. And so I think that's what I think it is. So I think to try to make it easy, where basically what runs through your income statement is close to or virtually the same as, you know, what it would have been under a rent type model, and you call it that, is something that I think people are going to be very interested in. I mean, I think even if you put it on the balance sheet. I think one, just further adding on to some comments been made by others, I think one other thing is the kind of gets back to Steve's comment earlier about behavioral change. And, you know, one of the things I think that does really, you know, you do have this stuff and you have it all the time and you are renting things along and typically for fairly short periods of time, usually in our case, you know, somewhere between 2 and 4 years for a specific project. And people look at that as part of the cost of the project and they build it into the project cost. They don't look at it ever as like a financing transaction or as a, and so we have lots of equipment, so lots of leased equipment. So just the effort and the physical effort of figuring out the net present value or whatever, you know, we're not equipped to do that today at all. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't get there if we have to, but I think that there's a lot of, that's a lot more of a change than I think. You know, if you just had 10 or 12 pieces of equipment, that'd be one thing. But when you have thousands of pieces of equipment and you need to look at them one by one. So one thing I would also ask in addition to, if we do go this route, is in addition to looking at this type A, type B, is to look at what might be able to be scoped out. There are probably some smaller, lesser core, I'm thinking about, you know, and again, depends on, these might be immaterial anyway, but, you know, the copy machine type stuff, some of the little stuff, if there was some way to kind of help companies figure out some way that if the obligation was less than a certain amount, that you just didn't have to go through all the mechanics, I think that would be helpful as well.
Okay, thank you. We have Tom Linsmeyer, then Steve, then Michael, and then we'll see if we're ready to move on to the lessor model.
Gerald said a lot of what I said, and it's going to build off what Annette just said, what I'm going to say here. But if I look at a hospital, I have a hard time believing when I look at a hospital that they don't have MRI machines and CAT scans, all right? And those are big-ticket items. I look, you know, I just don't, and if I'm a large distributor, if I have to distribute many things around the country that are very large, I think having containers to be able to move them around seem to be a fundamental asset to be able to do your business. So as a starting point, and that the lease contract creates a committed set of cash flows. Whether you want to call it debt or another obligation is really not up to us. We don't define debt. You know, how people perceive that is a different sort of thing. So it's very hard for me for the larger big ticket items to say I'm faithfully representing the economics of a business of the variety or a general manufacturer not having a crane to be able to deal with that. It would seem to me those are fundamental assets that should be recognized. And they meet the definitions of assets and liabilities. I think there's a fair question as to how you represent that in the income statement. And I think there's a fair question cost-beneficially as to whether small ticket items are worth the effort, okay, to be able to do that. And I think those are things that we're hearing. But to those of you responding to say, there are not an asset and a liability, I'm just giving you an explanation why I don't think, not just conceptually, but if I'm thinking about faithfully representing the economics of that business, I think there's a faithful representation to say you have those assets and you've got a bunch, you have some committed obligations to pay for them.
Okay, go ahead, Steve.
I think maybe just as a follow-up to some earlier comments that Annette had made about type B leases, I just wanted to make sure that from our perspective, it was clear that if this re-exposure draft was adopted or in some similar form, that there in fact be a very careful review of what a type B lease is, and that long-lived assets like aircraft, like rail cars, like, you know, rail locomotives, like marine cargo containers, which I can tell you have attributes very similar to real estate, because when a marine cargo container finishes its useful life in the marine service, it goes into a secondary market where it becomes a mobile storage asset that can live for 30 or 40 or 50 more years. These things are completely over-engineered. So something that's been in marine service for 10 or 15 years has another, you know, 25 to 50 years of life as a storage container. So I would ask that the board, you know, really give careful consideration to expanding its view on what a Type B lease is, and this concept of significance and consumption and what's significant and insignificant be given some really careful thought. Because, again, I believe there's a very strong argument to be made that for these longer-lived assets, whether they have real estate attributes or not, fall into that same category.
John Lacey had a point he wanted to make on that.
Just one other quick thought. I also teach accounting to judges several times a year. And when I explain to the judges that the lessee shows the asset on its books, but it doesn't own it, but the lessor doesn't show the asset on the books, but it does own it, they're very confused. So I think we want to be clear in our presentations in financial statements what we're really doing.
Okay. Michael?
We are in agreement with the putting the obligation on the balance sheet. We just struggle, I think, that a lot of leases can have different considerations in terms of how you come up with the lease payment that would be different than a loan. And so we struggle with the presentation of having interest expense, and we think we have a number of clients that's going to impact them a couple ways. One would be what gets included in contracts. And then the other is just once you move into smaller companies. I heard John Lacey make the comment your practitioners could handle the accounting. That doesn't mean the clients could handle the accounting. And so it just puts more on the auditor, I think, sometimes to come up with the appropriate accounting.
Go ahead, Larry Smith.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on something that Annette alluded to, and that is, you know, how to treat small ticket items, and she specifically mentioned copiers, and I think, I don't know if it was telephone systems or whatever. But and we've heard a lot of people say something like this, and some people have suggested that we ought to look at core versus non-core and not worry about the non-core, which many of us on both the IASB and the FASB struggle with, because it's fairly difficult to put together a definition of core versus non-core, and what's core to some people might be non-core to other people, and we think there would be some real difficulty in making those determinations. So at least at the FASB, I think we're fairly reluctant to try to do that. But with respect to small ticket items, I guess a number of us on the board struggle with why that's our problem. You know, every standard we put out has a little materiality box, et cetera, and it's been general practice since I've started with KPMG, I don't know how many thousands of years ago, that, you know, you don't worry about immaterial items, et cetera. And I guess, you know, there's nothing in GAAP right now that talks about a capitalization of PP&E and whether you need to, you know, companies basically take a policy or set a policy and say, you know, we're not going to capitalize anything that costs less than whatever the number is. And why can't we have the same thing here? I mean, if you have that many copy machines that it's going to be a material number, then I kind of scratch my head and say, well, why shouldn't that fall under this? But if they're truly small ticket items, why do we as standard setters have to deal with that?
Fair point. I think the concern really is with distributed business. I mean, we operate in more than 40 countries around the world, and we have no tracking of those things at all. So I don't think we know how many of them we have, to tell you the truth, because they're just considered a local office item. So I think the concern is when you get into dealing with auditors and you get into dealing with other people. But fair point in that maybe you do just say if the total value of the asset is less than what we would, you know, capitalize under our capital policy, then we just call it good. Okay, maybe that's something you would say. If you say, well, we don't capitalize anything if $10,000 is our threshold, then that's our threshold for these two. If the value of it is not more than that, then we'll just,
right.
Not even worry about it. And maybe that's okay. But I think whenever something new comes out and people look at it, they get frightened about, what all might really be out there. And I think in our case, because we're so broadly distributed and we have so many things around the world, I think some of the little stuff we don't really even track. The big stuff we do.
And I would argue that you probably don't keep track of all those items that theoretically are PP&E are going to last for years that fall underneath your capitalization policy, and you don't do anything with that right now.
We don't do anything with those either. You're right.
I'll turn around and do fair play this afternoon. We each speak for our own points of view.
Okay.
And, I think that we have heard significant issues about having to track a bunch of contracts to make the decision. And that doesn't mean that capitalization policy, like Larry said, isn't something that could come into play. But we've also heard some issues about running around the world, keeping track of thousands of contracts to make a conclusion that's immaterial. Is that something?
How cost
beneficial is that? Yeah. That doesn't mean that he's not right. In the end, that's the right thing to do. But
okay. Carol Yule?
I just wanted to say that the companies I work with are small contractors, and if they do work with the Texas Department of Transportation, they must use either GAP or IFRS. These are small companies, which means the materiality is low, and so the size of the leases that they'd have to consider is low. So I would encourage you that if you're going to scope out some types of leases, that you do it qualitatively, because for some of these companies, a $200 a month lease is going to be significant.
Darrell Buck?
I wanted to follow back with Michael on the trouble that you saw with interest on Type B leases. Would your remedy to that be to have a single Type A for all, or would it be to have undiscounted liability for Type B, or would it be to call the interest expense something else?
Whenever you get to complexity, I think that having to start accounting for some of these leases as loans and to discount, trying to get some of the symmetry to get lessor accounting, lessee accounting, where the measurements are the same, I understand why there's a discounting involved in the proposal. But that said, I think that introducing the interest component and the discounting adds another stream of accounting considerations that adds complexity to the accounting. The only way I know to get rid of it is to get rid of it. What that would do is there's clearly going to be leases. The longer you go through the asset's life, the more a lease starts to look like a financing. Shorter it gets, I think, the less it looks like one. And there are other considerations going to lease payments, to impose loan accounting or finance accounting, to me, just adds a layer of complexity. So I think there has to be some compromise to get simpler. You can either be conceptual or simple, and if you're going to say we have to be conceptual, I understand the interest. If you're going to tell me we need to simplify, then I think that's got to go.
So I think we're always, willing to consider potential simplifications or practical expedience, et cetera. Help me, though, because the difficulty that I can see is if we say at some point it starts to look like a financing, the problem we run into is at what point is that? How long-term does this Type B lease have to be before you would discount the liability?
About 90%.
Yeah, doesn't that criteria already exist?
Well,
it clearly exists, and you've already articulated it.
You could even, and this was just a thought, but if you start to have call something a lease and it actually is a sale, it transfers title, maybe that's not a lease. You can call a lot of things something other than what they are. And so leases maybe shouldn't include financings that are clearly transferring the title.
There's two issues with this government reimbursement issue. Is it conceptually incorrect to think that there's interest in these leases? First. Secondly, is it the issue as to how that interest is used in reimbursements? And some of this conversation is to say the tail wagging the dog, because it's going to affect reimbursements, we're going to argue that there isn't a financing component to the lease. And I'm not sure that I'm interested in whether that's a practical way to deal with the reimbursement problem, not believing that there's interest in the longer-term leases, or it's just we want to avoid the reimbursement problem?
I think it's a little bit of both. But I think one of the things that the government, in my experience, you know, to some degree, they can almost be as narrow as saying we will only reimburse you for what you paid in cash. Okay, so I mean there is kind of almost that view. So for the most part, what we have called rent expense has been very similar to what we paid in cash, and so I think that's kind of worked. So now they could maybe change their model. I think you could say there's an interest component. I would argue, though, and you may disagree, but that in some of these shorter term type transactions where maybe you do have a right of use and maybe you do have a commitment, okay, give you that, but do you really have a financing? And I would say no. I would say in some of these shorter term type deals where you have a 3 or 4 year deal, the intent is always to use it for a short period of time and put it back, that there would not really be an interest component, that it really is just, it's pretty much rent, you know, for that short period of time, and that the asset is clearly owned and taken by the lessor. But, I mean, that's a debatable, I agree that's a debatable point. But my view would be that we don't really have interest in if you define that type of transaction right.
Mike wants to say something, and then we do need to move on to lessor account.
I think the idea of an obligation to me is different than the concept of a loan. I tend to think of a loan involving a third party or just a separate financial commitment that bears interest, and it was negotiated, and I could have elected to have a loan or not. And when I think in terms of a lease, I have no ability to prepay. It's just the agreement I entered into, and there may be an element of interest involved, but there were other elements as well. So I just think it's imposing a concept on it that may not be there. In other words, it's just a rent payment.
Well, in part, my question is, if you had the ability to prepay, would you pay less than what the obligation is? And I think the answer is probably yes. And so the inherent in there is a time value of money concept that we
yes.
represent as interest. And I understand the...
I just don't know if it's worth measuring.
Right. Well, I think part of this, a lot of all of these things, when we say small ticket or shorter time periods, is it worth the distinction? Is it material? And Larry asked the right question is, could materiality be the excuse not to do some of these things? But that's a challenge for all of the system to implement well.
And there are trade-offs, too, as I said this morning in my closing comments. If you accept the fact that we can't be conceptually perfect in every aspect of this proposal, which I think we're sort of proving that with every time we have a discussion, if you say, okay, it is financing, and so it should be, you know, you should have a discount liability and you should unwind that and have interest, well, if it's not that important, then is the trade-off that you go undiscounted and accept the fact that you're not reflecting the liability exactly right? I mean, there's
that.
You just got to weigh which one's.
That would be where more important. I would go. That's a simpler approach. Not necessarily better, it's just simpler.
Okay, let's move on to lessor accounting. We'll have some time for closing comments and maybe to double back on a couple of things here. But Danielle's going to tee up the lessor model.
Okay, so on the agenda, I'm on page 3 again at the top. We go through the lessor accounting model. And again, we have type A and type B with the same line. And type A lessors would derecognize the underlying asset, recognize a lease receivable and a residual asset. And then there might be day one profit, and there would be interest income recognized on both the receivable and the residual. And that would, again, apply to most leases of assets other than property. than for type B leases. For most leases of property, you would have an approach that pretty much is the same as current operating lease accounting for lessors today. So our questions 3 and 4 address the lessor accounting proposals, and we want to find out what you think about what we proposed, how that depicts the different types of leases, what provides the better information, and if you don't agree with the proposals, what suggestions you have for the boards on the lessor accounting model.
Okay, terrific. We have a few lessors around the table, starting with Steve.
Thank you. I think as we think, some other members have said this earlier, that as we think about presenting our organization to the outside world and how they view and understand what it is that we do for a living, they think of us as asset managers. And to my way of thinking, that's the way our balance sheet works today. We have assets that we intensively manage. Some of them we see 5 or 10 times over a 15-year life cycle. We repair them, we maintain them, we put them back out on lease, and we depreciate them. But our core business is generating cash flows from renting them, and we have some operating expenses associated with that, and the difference really is profit. Pre-interest, pre-tax, pre-depreciation profit. So we don't, as an entity that borrows, again, in multiples of billions of dollars in the capital markets, don't find today that the user community is saying, we don't understand your business. We don't understand your business model. We don't understand the way it's manifested in your financial statements. And we deal with every large major banking institution in the States, many in Europe, some in Asia, and all of the large insurance companies in the United States. The advisory committee, the IAC, I think, has come back and said, challenged whether there is a change that is necessary for lessor accounting. Standard & Poor's, who rates our debt, has come out explicitly and urged, I think, the board to reconsider the proposed changes. And I mentioned the type A, type B classification, which we can come back to as we get into that. But the other thing I'd ask you to consider is a lot of the leasing companies, certainly in the long-lived transportation leasing world, finance themselves using something, a concept called a borrowing base. And that borrowing base is a very well-established construct that is used as an estimation of what the value of the asset is. So we borrow against our entire capital structure, $3 billion of debt at present, is built on the premise of the existing valuation that we show on our balance sheet for the residual value of those assets, the true net book value. If we begin breaking that up into a receivable component and a residual component that we evaluate at multiple points over the life and continually change, while the margin might be very minimal in terms of the incremental change, the impact and the havoc that it will wreak on raising capital in our business will be substantial. And then lastly, the cost aspect. And that cost aspect is very real for a company of our size. We have 175 people globally. We're a privately held company. We've been privately held since the inception of the company in 1980. And just on as a base estimate, we're thinking this is going to be in the $5 million kind of range for a company our size to do the development work to implement a change like this, and then likely have at least a seven-figure cost to it annually in terms of maintaining, excluding any kind of legal costs that we'd have redoing our documentation, renegotiating every loan agreement that we have in our portfolio of financing transactions.
Okay. Larry Smith has a question.
So the borrowing base that you referred to, that's a book value-based number as opposed to a fair value-based number? And I don't know where you are in your life in terms of selling off what used to be leased assets, but I mean, generally, do you keep them until effectively they're just scrap?
No. Not at all. I mean, they have a very high residual value, most of those assets.
So you generally sell them for a gain?
We can sell them for gains. It's really a function of what the original cost of the asset was and what's happening in the secondary market. The secondary market is disconnected from the primary marine container market. So it's okay. Not that we're selling them to shipping lines. We're actually selling them into the mobile storage market.
Right.
We're selling them into, you know, international markets.
Okay.
So that's a little different from what we heard this morning on airplanes, right?
Correct.
Okay. Brad and then Matt and then Jeff.
From our perspective on the lessor accounting, it's really more of an operational issue. Our company primarily originates direct finance leases today, and so when I think about the new model where we would have type A leases, the accounting is going to be very similar. From an operational perspective, though, the concern that we have is with a portfolio of our size. I thought it was big, but when I say 140,000 leases, there's obviously larger portfolios around this table. But when you have a contract that goes into renewal, my understanding is that there's some concept that there has to be a reassessment of that lease term to determine whether or not the lessee has a significant economic incentive to go into renewals and to make those renewal payments. In the small ticket industry that we're in, the lease would just continue on a month-to-month basis. It would continue on the same payment terms that that lessee had. And so in my mind, there's never a significant economic incentive for them to exercise it, but I don't ultimately know their circumstances. And really with a portfolio our size, we really don't have the ability to go in on a lease by lease basis and make that assessment. And so really what I question in changing it is that our results are going to be very similar to what they are today, but from an administrative perspective, that's going to be difficult, if not almost impossible, for us to be able to make that evaluation.
Matt Brewer.
So our membership is rarely in the leasing business to any significant extent. The thought is that the area of concern is not the lessor side, and I would like to point out that there is a significant concern about a long-term lease as a property that would be type B leases becoming type A leases. We may universities regularly receive gifts of land, and oftentimes the land gift may be rather generous, but the university may have an operating budget that's not going to support the development of that land in the near term, so that land is often leased for the long term. And especially if we had a situation in our membership where the land was part of a permanently restricted endowment, then we would be violating the donor restriction if we were to recognize that we had in fact sold that land, because the portion of the lease was that significant to the fair value of the land. And so the thought is we would first have an issue with the donor restriction, and then at the end of the lease, what happens, that land is now written right back onto the book. So this is something we're grappling with, and we didn't have somebody definitely point this out, although George Washington University comment letter 274 does a pretty good job with this topic. But we do regularly have long-term leases of land that we think would be troublesome, and so our thought is that we would need to try to find a way to keep those in the type B category.
Somebody also raised the possibility of carrying these at fair value?
That's correct. I mean, our ultimate thought here, and I'll jump ahead not too long to scope exception, would be most of the time investment property is indeed carried at fair value by non-for-profits, and that is allowed under U.S. GAAP. I think there's some confusion about that in one of the BCs. So, yes, we can carry that at fair value. So the proposal is that the land be carried at fair value, and then we recognize the income from the lease, and then we don't have these leases recognized.
Go ahead, Darrell.
Yeah, Matt, just to follow up, I just want to make sure that I understood correctly. You get a contribution of land that's permanently restricted. You're not going to do anything with it, so you're leasing it out, and it's a type A lease. And so you're saying the derecognition of that asset from your books is, quote, treated as a sale and would violate the restriction? Is that, have that I got that right?
The concern would be that someone would look at this from the outside and say, well, wait, this land is not on your books, but you told the owner you would forever keep this property.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Jeff, one way to deal with that might be able to introduce the notion of restrictions and whether you really can sell something that you own that's restricted.
So as our companies looked at this, the objective of the revised lease account exposure draft is to recognize lease assets and liabilities on the balance sheet and disclose key information. From a lessor accounting perspective, that is already occurring. Everything is already on, at least it is on our balance sheet. We disclose every single lease that we have, either as a finance lease in today's world or an operating lease. So to echo some comments that Brett and Steve made as well, from a cost standpoint, we see zero benefit from it, and yet there will be a monumental cost incurred. Again, we're a mid-size independent lessor with two owners since 1992, and to change this would take a significant piece of our equity that we've been able to build up over time. The second thing is to this month-to-month idea. We have a finite base of customers. We try to treat every hospital we have with the best possible care that we possibly can. Those are our customers. We do everything we can with them to make sure they are happy with what they are receiving from a service from us. And we go month to month. We don't have evergreen leases. We don't have some of these issues that the leasing world is known for. And we see any change in that lessor accounting model to try to go, are they going to go month to month, or 12 months, 24 months? I don't know. At the end, we are very fair with them and try to do what's best for the hospital.
Okay. We have Michael Beck and then Annette.
The part I struggle with the most, I guess, is the derecognition, especially when you move into an asset where it's more than an insignificant but less than substantially all. If I tried to get sale accounting treatment on that under existing U.S. GAAP, I don't think I would get there. And to get it with a lease bothers me a little bit. And then I think once you do that, then we start with the imputing interest on the residual asset. To me, it's still an in-use or an asset held for use. So I felt like the accounting for a lessor, keeping the asset on the books, actually did reflect what was going on. I do agree that the receivable is an asset, but I struggle with doubling up the balance sheet. So in that particular instance, I almost default back to more of a disclosure or an offsetting. But I have a very difficult time trying to find my way through to the derecognition and how that works.
Okay. Annette?
This is just a little bit of a revisit of something that was talked about this morning, and Marion touched on it. I just kind of want to add a couple of comments, but we are one of the companies that does have an entity that leases equipment and then subleases it to other legal entities. So within Bechtel, we probably have 50 to 80 operating legal entities around the world, and so you have one entity, and they all have to prepare statutory accounts and other things, either under IFRS or US GAAP. So we have one entity that could both be a lessor and a lessee of the same equipment, as well as then the inter-entity thing between them and these entities, either in the United States or other places where they facilitate that lease transaction. So the related party thing for me, I mean, at the end of the day, most of these smaller legal entities, we do separate financial statements on them, but most of that is really just to comply with statutory requirements and that kind of thing. But if we have to account for these things separately in each of these little entities, then consolidation is going to just be a complete nightmare. And so the concern really there is to try to link about simplification on related party transactions. Okay with disclosure, okay to say this isn't completely arm's length. You know, one thing leased it and they leased it to the other one, and we're just going to treat it like an operating type lease or something. But if you end up capitalizing it on, you know, different sets of books and then having to kind of figure out how to eliminate that, that's going to be a big issue for us.
Jeff. Go ahead, Darrell.
So I think this morning the question and discussion around that helped me because, well, first of all, when we were proposing the treatment for related party leases that we did, I think we thought that we were helping things in terms of, you know, not requiring people to account for the substance of the transactions, but just let them use the form of it, be simple, add some disclosure that it's related party, and that's easy. I think that the response this morning to my question, though, clarified to me that wasn't really the issue. The issue was that for these related party transactions, you didn't really want to apply the new model, essentially. You wanted to have an exemption from doing that.
Right.
I guess I can understand that sort of within the group as pertains to the consolidated financial statements. But to the extent that any one of these individual subsidiary-type companies produces its own standalone financial statements, don't you think that that's problematic to have a carve-out and have those treated separately than the leases that they might have that are not related party?
I'll put on my private company hat now, but none of our legal entities, any of them, have separate debt agreements. None of them have, they don't control their own cash. They're absolutely, you know, to do business in certain countries and stay in conformance with the tax rules. And so I think and to also sometimes be able to serve customers in those locations. And I think the complexity that we're adding here for that, when you don't really have the, you know, when they really are so interrelated with the hub, is really adding a level of work that is just not beneficial.
Okay, so let me understand then, though. If you don't do standalone financial statements.
We do standalone financial statements, audited standalone financial statements.
For statutory purposes,
but not for lending, and not of course we're not public, so you know, we don't bond or borrow or any of that with these entities. Okay.
So if you have a sub in Europe, you just have to do statutory because it's required by the government.
Right. And in some cases, we do a set of financial statements because we just want to have it for that entity because we have to have. Sometimes we have reporting requirements for states for contract licensing and that kind of thing.
Would you feel differently if your foreign subsidiary did in fact go out and independently borrow at the subsidiary level?
You know, I think my view there would be if you adequately disclose it and you say, here's the commitment I have and my commitment is internal to my parent company, because you have to disclose your parent company and who they are. We have to disclose a lot. We disclose a lot of related party transactions in our various legal entities because
is your intercompany debt displayed on the balance sheet of those foreign subsidiaries?
If we have any, yeah. We have intercompany debt. We don't have any debt with third party on those, but we, you know.
No, I meant intercompany.
Yeah, if we have intercompany debt, yes, it's displayed and it's disclosed.
But
our intercompany financing agreements, if we have any of those, are displayed and disclosed.
But if I hear you, and part of that is just that, look, this is just not presumed to be arm's length. We were following the form, and I think if I hear you, you're saying it's just easier to treat them all as what we think of as operating today.
Absolutely.
And just flow the cash flow through.
Right, and happy to disclose, okay?
Okay.
It's not clear that exempting all related party leases is that it might go too far. Your issues are intergroup.
They're intergroup.
Yeah.
They are definitely intergroup.
In a consolidated sort of situation, and it's not clear that all related party transactions are about in a consolidated setting, so it'll be an interesting additional challenge for us to think about.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I think we're ready to move on to measurement. So Lisa will tee that up.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, so if everyone turns to page 5 of your agenda, you'll see questions 5 through 8. These are going to be regarding measurement. And the three main topics that the staff and the board wanted to discuss here relate to the lease term, variable lease payments, and reassessment for both of those. In response to some feedback we heard from the 2010 ED, the boards have worked to simplify some of the proposals, and you'll see specific examples of that with the lease term and variable lease payments. For the lease term, you now only include renewals if there's a significant economic incentive. And for variable lease payments, you only include them in your measurement of your liability if they're linked to an index or rate. So what we would be interested in hearing from you is whether or not you agree with the proposals, whether you disagree, and if you disagree, why, and then any suggestions.
Okay. We'd like to start off the discussion on measurement.
Does that mean you all agree? Maybe we'll try the same thing.
Again, variable lease payments. I'm sure somebody wants to speak about variable lease payments, if nothing else. Does anybody deal with variable lease payments?
Tom? Okay, I can't John. Ask the valuation guy how he does it.
A nice conversation.
Go ahead, Jeff. Thank you.
We do have some variable lease payments based off of usage on a disposable product from a hospital standpoint where they are using a different, or that's how they've chosen to to structure the lease is based off of that. So, you know, all of our interest rates are fixed. We do not use any variable interest rates, but we do have some transactions that do involve usage that, again, complicating that in any manner is a disservice to the hospital from our point of view. And I don't see how a hospital would want to treat those differently than they are today.
So based on that, that's the ED doesn't change those for you, I guess.
So they're not based on index, they're based on usage.
Correct.
Okay.
But we don't have a lot.
Mark, what about from your perspective?
Yeah, I would say that we don't see a lot of variable lease payments. Occasionally, you will see some CPI adjustments. And the question there is, under today's method versus having to reconsider that every year, it seems like you kind of get to the same place, but there's an awful lot more work if you have to reconsider it every year. So that seems like it would be a challenge. One thing you mentioned earlier relating to lease term, and this is something that I think there was an improvement in from the first meeting and second, we still have the existing concept of a significant economic incentive. And I'll tell you, even under the old guidance, that was sometimes difficult to evaluate if there was a bright line with that, if it was where it was. So that's just another challenge. But I think there was clearly an improvement from the first release to the second relative to lease term.
Okay. Anything else in this area? Okay, sorry, Matt. Michael, go ahead.
Just a brief comment. We agree with the proposal. The only thing we noted that we would suggest would be not to require the reassessment for changes in an index. Just go ahead and flow that through and disclose it just because of complexity.
Okay. Daryl?
I was just going to follow up with Jeff. If your customers came to you and said, hey, how about we structure all of our leases to be based on usage? And let's also add the additional factor that let's just say that this became prevalent in the industry because of our proposal. And so from a competitive standpoint, you might feel compelled to consider it. How do you think that would play out?
So that's a good question. I think Mark can speak to this as well. About 15 years ago, I would say these usage programs were much more prevalent in the hospital world. I think as far as reimbursements, Medicare, Medicaid, whoever caught on to it, the insurance companies, that these things were occurring. But this used to be much more prevalent in the business. I can see, especially somebody like us, where we're a middle-sized independent lessor, we will do what we need to garner business. We will adapt. I mean, we're not a bank. We're not. That's something we can do is become much more nimble. Because we understand the hospital and what they'll use.
Would you think that would affect your pricing model, though?
Not a great deal, because on our current transactions that are like that, it does not affect the pricing.
Okay. Michael wanted to weigh in here.
Where we've seen that is you'll suddenly get minimum usages introduced into the contract.
Okay.
But bottom line, a lessor is always going to recover, the cost that's involved in the asset. And so they'll do anything as long as they're protected on that floor.
I think we've talked about, you can just call it a different thing, but minimum usage would be used.
And that be considered a fixed payment?
Yeah, but...
The minimum.
Yes, the minimum payment piece would, and again, I mean, in the hospital world, you know what they're going to use. You can get information on how many disposable sets they're using and price it accordingly. I mean, there would be ways, at least in our world, to do something.
Okay. Matt, then John.
Quickly on discount rates. While there are plenty of members, I think that would prefer to have an undiscounted liability, or they say they would, until perhaps they have to deal with debt ratios. We're generally in support of having discounted liabilities. We feel that the membership of Nakubo shouldn't have too much of a problem figuring out incremental borrowing rates, although at the smaller end of the institutional spectrum, if they don't have public debt, they may have some difficulty. We do think that the use of the risk-free rate is a good option to offer, especially to small not-for-profit entities, which will have a hard time figuring out their incremental rate, although it may result in higher liabilities for them. We don't support reassessing discount rates unless there are significant changes to lease terms.
Okay. John, you're next.
We deliberated all these issues at our committee and agreed that we could do them. So we thought the approach was good.
Okay, anybody else on the area of measurement?
Oh. Is this all of the measurement questions?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to say that what we were looking at is that the risk-free rate or any non-zero discount rate requires that the person computing it have present value software. Unfortunately, the small companies I work with don't, which is okay because they don't have accountants normally. So what I would just encourage is allow as a if it's not reasonably practicable to discount the cash flows, allow a zero discount rate. It's conservative, and if you're going to allow the risk-free rate anyway, then you're not going to have comparability.
Okay. Anything else in the area of measurement? Okay, if not... I think we can take our break a little bit early. So we'll reconvene in 15 minutes, which is at a little bit before 2:45.
And would a zero discount rate be something that would be satisfactory to the private company community? And if you ended up with a Type B lease, that means depreciation would be higher. You'd have no interest expense. Is that something that, and a higher obligation, is that something that has traction other than with Carol?
She said as an option, right?
Yeah. As an option.
I think it would be an option. I actually do think it would be an option.
I teach this in introductory accounting. I don't know. It seems that one should be able to figure that out. Right? Some discount rate.
If that were an option and you were to elect it, would it come packaged with straight line amortization of the asset as opposed to Type B with some sort of an incremental borrowing rate? You have the annuity base to get the straight line total effect.
Yeah. I mean, I think it
would. You would assume that you would do what was necessary to get the straight line P&L total effect?
I mean, not to get too debit-y credit-y here, but essentially, if you have a mortgage, you can pay $100 a year for 4 years. Okay, your obligation is $400. Okay, and every time you make a rent payment, you debit the liability and you credit cash. Okay, and then on the asset side, you got $400 and you amortize off $100 a year, which is equal to what your cash payment is. That's pretty darn simple. I don't know how it gets a whole lot easier than that.
How costly is discount software?
It's not that costly, but if There are some construction companies that only have two or three employees. Those two or three employees are the guy who runs it and runs the jobs, probably either his wife or his secretary, and maybe another person. So it's not the cost of the software. It's that the accounting function isn't as sophisticated as it might be.
It would deal with the reimbursable issue, wouldn't it?
It would. I think it's going to be easier for people to, the reason I would say optional is I think the shorter the term, the more palatable that becomes, okay? You know, if, particularly if you were going to be using the risk-free rate, the difference is going to be not that great over a short period of time.
Just if your board members may recall that when we were working with the PCFRC on this, they did suggest, I think, with maybe a three-year limit, you know, this type of an approach. Okay, let's take our break.
Nice thought.
We'll be back in 15 minutes.
It was a question, not more than that.